Mini-episode 1051 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late-night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome to FDH Lounge Mini Episode 1051. I'm FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris, here to introduce the latest incarnation of our series, recounting our greatest guest moments, this one from Mini Episodes 951 to 1050. Today we take a look back at conversations with so many interesting guests during that time frame. Chidi Ahanotu, John Bastow, Cornelius Bennett, Adam Buckman, Vance Johnson, Jackie the Joke Man Martling, Jake the Snake Roberts, and Phil Villapiano. The breadth of our conversations with these guests continues to reinforce the credo of the FDH Lounge as the show where nothing is off topic. What we saw in the NFC playoffs here, Foles was not aggressive in the first game, didn't look so great, was aggressive against Minnesota. I think he's got to stay aggressive, but still not make mistakes. And if that sounds hard to do against New England in the Super Bowl, maybe that's why they're the underdogs. But I think Foles has to thread that needle of being aggressive but not turning the ball over. I think the Eagles have to be able to establish time of possession in their favor. They've been a good time of possession team. They got the power backs. I think they got to be able to thump New England enough to be able to maintain the time of possession in their favor. And I think they've got to be able to get a good pass rush going with just the front four there. Teams that have done that against Brady in the playoffs historically have had a lot of success. But if you can do the four-man rush, make it effective, that's something that plays to the Eagles' strengths. So your thoughts on that, Chidi? Agree or disagree with me on those being big keys for the game?
No, I agree wholeheartedly, Rick. That's definitely the game plan to beat the Patriots. I think they can definitely execute that game plan. You know, this Patriots team isn't the greatest of Patriots teams that we've seen in the past. They have a lot of holes and weaknesses. So if they can do what they did against Minnesota, against the Giants during the season, I think they have a really good chance to win this game. And, you know, if you can include a couple of big plays on that defense, by that defense, like they've been doing, you know, crucial turnovers, interceptions or fumbles, that's just more of a dagger against New England. So I think it's definitely doable. And it'll be one of the biggest upsets ever.
To make that analogy to real-world stuff here, it is almost like revolutions, like literally, like the Cultural Revolution in China of the 70s. Like, this is a thing of, like, where in certain countries, people would be, like, revered and big-time powerful and all this stuff, and then, like, the change happens, it blows through, the revolution happens, and we don't talk about them anymore. Because you're right, you couldn't get bigger than Harvey Weinstein was in Hollywood. That's part of how he was able to get away with everything that he did. And on and on and on with so many other powerful figures. And like you said, it goes beyond Hollywood to the Matt Lauers and some of the other people to get implicated in this. Ones that a lot of people found shocking, like I did with Charlie Rose. It really sort of is the whole thing of, you know, you think you know somebody from TV, but you don't necessarily know them. But the way that it happened, like you said, with Seacrest, the allegations that are out there, it really kind of put I don't know if you'd say a cloud necessarily on the red carpet, but you knew going in it was going to be different this year.
Huge. And yeah, I mean, it's more so than a cloud. It definitely, I mean, that's like not talking about the elephant in the room. And everybody, and I think it was, it must have been horrible being him in that situation, because there was so much press beforehand about who's going to talk to him. Who's going to talk to him? So it's not even more polite on that. If somebody did talk to him, maybe they were, like, you know, going against the movement or not, you know, believing in the movement. And then if somebody didn't talk to him, it immediately made the statement like, oh, well, they obviously believe the allegations. Meanwhile, just always remember, with any of these things that are non-proven, in this world, anybody can say anything about anyone, period. No matter, so that's why in this country, you're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. So until somebody's proven guilty, you know, don't treat them totally like a fry unless you have inside knowledge that you know what's being said is being true. Because otherwise, you know, you're absolutely ruining that person's life because other people are watching your actions and making decisions based on your actions. And if your actions are based on just hearsay or third party, you know, talk and accusations on a hot button issue, that could be ruining somebody's life.
We haven't had that same degree of creativity defensively, somebody who's come in and really kind of changed the game defensively. So my question to you on a theoretical level, and just whatever you think it might be, whatever it might consist of, is when we get a guy who's the Mike Martz of defense in the NFL, what's your best guess as to what that might look like and the directions that they might go in?
Well, I kind of disagree with you in a sense as far as from a player's perspective, because coaches can only, you know, strategize or whatever.
Sure.
But when you go back and the guy who I was labeled after, and every other outside linebacker since he came in the league was labeled after, is Lawrence Taylor, and you talk about from a defensive perspective, there's nobody changed the game of defense in the history of the game since, you know, since before or since the way he did. And although I was a good you know, representation of it, you know, I still say he's the best, and Derek Thomas, you know, ended up being the best pass rushing outside linebacker, personal outside linebacker in the history of the game, in my opinion. When you have a guy on defense that you can move around and change the game that way, I just, again, it's almost like offense with the kid out of Louisville this year as quarterback. I just think the coaches have to understand that when you have a special person like that, you have to adjust, just like you make adjustments during a game. But coaches are so into what they do and how they were taught or whatever. I think that just they're afraid to think outside of the box, except for the fact of Mouse and June back in the day and Mike Martz. When you have one football and multiple guys on your offensive team, you know, running back Marshall Faulk and then your two receivers that you had in Bruce and the other kid Holt, you have to figure out, you know, you have to change the game plan. You got to change it up because you got triple threats. Do you know you got to get the ball to those guys, because anytime you touch the ball, it's a potential touchdown. And on the same on defense, when you have talented guys, you have to move them around, put them in a position to take that one football away at a game. And it's just a matter of the coaches, coaching involvement with the players, because the game has changed. You've gone from slow guys, you know, I was, you know, particularly slow, but now everybody's big, strong, and fast. You know, it's almost even across the board when you look at it position by position. So I would, you know, I would look at the coaching changing as far as evolving, because the players have evolved. So, you know, you have the coaches have to evolve with time as well.
But again, you know, as much as I think it was better at that point in time, it just sort of backs up my point. Both Letterman and Stern, in ways that are underrated for each of them, I think, have been chameleons throughout pop culture in these 35 years and been able to adapt.
Yeah, so not only that, yeah, and in fact, that's the key to the reason why they are like, they are such titans or icons, because of their lasting quality. I mean, Howard Stern's been on TV on radio a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, and I remember when he would occasionally do interviews. I mean, not with me, but there'd be interviews when he was at the height of his morning radio show, you know, and he would say, in all honesty, and he probably talked about this on the radio because he was always so honest about his life and how this even contributed to the collapse of his marriage and things like this. You know, broadcasting is an exhausting thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
If you're Howard Stern, you're tired every day, because that kind of contentious 4 or 4.5 hours of work starting in the early morning is can wipe you out.
Right.
And in a way, the endurance is not only an ability to, as you say, you know, adapt to cultural changes or in his case, help bring them about in sort of a gradual way. But it's also sheer physical and mental willpower to get through that kind of thing. And Letterman, too. You know, I think Johnny Carson was in some weird way kind of nuts for doing a show every day. And it made him kind of crazy. It made him, I mean, not crazy like he was a lunatic who was, you know, sitting in his office babbling to himself. But, I mean, it makes them wary of the public. And live relatively reclusive lives, even though money helps pay for those reclusions, and they do have friends and things like this. But it's a very interesting lifestyle that even in all the years I've covered people like this and observed them from the outside, I still don't have a full understanding of what their lives are like.
Sure.
I mean, Dave was on for an hour every day, and during the rest of the day, I understand that in the offices of the Ed Sullivan Theater, very few people really spoke to Dave.
Yeah.
This is what I always say, I say to people. You know, this came up as recently as a year or two ago, when you know the Steve Harvey's memo got publicized.
Mm-hmm.
That he put out that memo where he told people in the office, "You got to stop waylaying me in the hallway asking for selfies and autographs. It's ridiculous." And everybody came out against Steve Harvey, and I wrote a column that said, come on, the thing he does is hard work. If he's going from place to place, it means he's thinking about what he has to say on TV.
Right.
So if you stop him for a selfie, you know, then you have no idea what goes into this work. Broadcasting
right.
was hard work. It might still be for some. And this is the respect I have for people like Letterman and Stern. Really, like broadcasting Hall of Famers.
This is, I think, a perfectly legitimate question to ask from a football historian point of view. But at least in 86, 87 there with the Drive, I guess you could look at some of the other ones subsequently. I'm sure you, in being intellectually honest, would have to admit, if Don Rogers is still alive, at the very least, that drive is certainly more difficult to come by, and maybe some of the other things here. That's one of the big what-ifs in this town. I mean, it's a human tragedy to be sure, but boy, for what that guy was able to do on the field, very Ronnie Lott-esque. I got to say, that's one of the big what-ifs around here.
It sure is. In fact, to this day, and it's been a number, 30 years? It's been so long, and I've never even forgotten the fact that a miracle was pulled off in that stadium. And I would imagine people for generations there in Cleveland are just never going to forget, you know, the letdown that happened when that great John Elway took us down the field and somehow by a miracle, like I mentioned, we scored, you know, to tie the ball game, and we still had to come back and win it. So it was something that probably will never happen in the history of the league again, especially going into an AFC championship game with 99.5 yards to go and not a lot of time on the clock. So I remember like it was yesterday. In fact, I talk about it almost daily when I talk about my journey in life now and how sometimes you find yourself where no one believes you're going to pull something out, but somehow, some way, you figure out how to get out of it. And that's exactly what the Broncos did, and I was able to attest to it because I was on the field the whole time during those two comebacks.
Yeah, that's a very tangible representation of that, to be sure. And I got to say that, you know, this is a thing that only happens in Cleveland. Nobody outside of Cleveland, strangely enough, ever notices this. We always put game-winning field goal with Rich Carlos. We always put that in air quotes because everyone around here will say, if you look at it, did it actually go over the goalpost? Did it not? I mean, there are people around here, and I got to say, myself included, they're like, maybe the NFL should have looked at that one.
You know, I'll tell you what. Rich Carlos was one of the worst field goal kickers in the history of the game, and that's the reason why we always wanted to be as close as possible, because he was going to put a hook in there, and so you never know by the way that ball was curving, almost like a slice shot or a big hook on the drive when you're hitting a golf ball, whether or not that thing really ended up inside the goalpost. It doesn't really matter to me now, but I guarantee if I was on the other side of the field, I'd be screaming to this day that there's no way that it went inside the goal.
Well, I got to tell you, it's only in recent years I've been able to bring myself to pull that up on YouTube and watch it. And it's interesting that at the time, nobody questioned it. It was like, oh, okay, it went in, it whatever. But then, like, subsequently in Cleveland, it was like, you know, maybe they should have taken a look at that one. So,
only
you know.
In Cleveland, brother. That's right.
That's right. That's right. Nobody ever notices that outside of here.
I don't know what the worst call was, Johnny Manziel or that field goal. Made or missed field goal.
For anybody that believes the whole story of Jackie was greedy and bitter and whatever, like, I felt like you were telling your story, but not going out of your way to sort of be defensive or anything like that. Like, you can believe me or not believe me, but this is the way that it went. So when you were writing it, in terms of your approach, how much hope did you have of reaching anybody that already had this picture in their head?
I didn't care.
Okay.
You know, it's like trying to reach Trump's people.
Yeah.
You know, what they've already made up their mind, they're not budging. You know, all I know is it was, you know, I've been writing that book as it went along for 20 years, you know, assembling my stories. And it's funny because I'll run into somebody and, well, now that the book's out, it's different, but people will come up and ask me questions, and I would answer them, and they'd say, man, that's what you said 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, that's what happened, you know, because Howard changes the story every 5 minutes, and here I am, you know, the guy asked me something, I tell him the answer, and he's like, well, you know, well, that's the whole idea. If you tell it, you know, Mark Twain said, if you tell the truth, you never have to remember anything.
Sure. Yeah, so, that's true. That's
and,
true.
Yeah, so I hope people would enjoy it. And it's so funny because I have so many smart friends that are like, wow, man, I love your writing. It's so accessible. I mean, it feels like you're right there. And then, you know, I see these reviews from these Sternites, you know, Jackie Martling's illiterate. He can't write a book. He should have got some help. And then other people said he didn't write this book himself. And you know that, you know, anybody gives a good review, must have been written by Jackie. You know, the attack dogs never stop.
Right.
But they never will. And you know, I mean, I got enough hard bark on me in those 15 years that, you know, what are they going to do? They're not going to penetrate me now, you know?
Everybody thinks about your feud with Savage in 91, 92. What I go to, the match in late 86 on Saturday night's main event because the way that everything was so spoon-fed back in the days, good guy in this corner, bad guy in this corner, they send you and Randy Savage out there. You guys both multi-talented as far as your psychology. I mean, Vince never trusted anybody to go out there and not be in a clear-cut, defined role, and they put you guys out there in a sort of experimental thing. That shows the trust in you right there, I think.
Yeah, it was a spot because Hogan wasn't on that show.
Right.
So it was the first time anybody went out there and was given as much time as we were given to. Now, the bad thing was we got Dick Ebersol in the back, and he's telling me and Randy that if you guys don't hold the numbers, if you come back from commercials, you'll be back in Poughkeepsie doing local television real quick. You know, and that was the worst thing in the world to tell Randy.
Right.
Because Randy, you're like, oh, my God, brother, we got to do something special. No, you don't. What you do is you do what got you there. You know,
mm-hmm.
You don't change that. Randy wanted to change his whole gimmick around and do this other stuff. Like, Randy, what are you talking about? And basically the first 5-7 minutes of that match, I just blocked him off, and that's all I did.
Uh-huh.
Blocked him, kept him off of me, because he wanted to eat me alive. And I wasn't going to let him do that, you know, because what are you going to do for the next 20 minutes?
Right.
You know? But we made it, man. We, you know, I had some great times with Randy. You know, the thing with Elizabeth and him, and it was awesome. And, you know, that match should have went on to WrestleMania. But Randy hadn't smartened his in-laws up. And whenever I slapped Elizabeth, the in-laws went off on him.
Oh.
And basically told him, don't you ever come back. And we'll shoot your ass if you try to come in this house. And they ran him off. You know, because you said you'd never let a little girl get hurt. Well, she got slapped by a big man, you know, blah, 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 blah. And, man, I see Randy, and he's pulling his hair out, man. He didn't have much left. And, you know, they were gonna split those two up afterwards.
Uh-huh.
You know, no, she's not going back with you. You know, I get another opportunity to hurt her, you know. And he goes, I got to do something right now. I got to beat you. I got to do this to you. I got to do that. I'm like, wait a minute. What the hell? You know, but that's the way it went, man. We had to get out of it in a hurry because, her family were ready to shoot him. I thought it was pretty funny. But unfortunately, it was cut short, and it really was.
I'm wondering if we jab some truth serum into some of the players. They're thinking to themselves, gee whiz, did I grab the short straw here, the Twin Cities, as opposed to New Orleans or another place? Like that, you know, I tend to think of that song, that great song that Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly had from Step Brothers, Boats and Hoes. That's kind of the imagery that a lot of us get of Super Bowl week. They're in the Twin Cities.
Yeah.
Honest answer, Phil. How much of a letdown do you think it would be for players to be going there as opposed to a warm weather fun city in February?
You know, it's really nutty. We played in the Rose Bowl. It doesn't get much better than that. We played against the Vikings. So the Vikings came to the Rose Bowl to play the Rays.
show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.